Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. There's another new Frontline documentary out about COVID-19. It is called The Virus, What Went Wrong? It explores why the United States was so unprepared. Despite repeated warnings, U.S. leaders failed to act. In the documentary, Dr. David Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center at Columbia University, said, if Donald Trump were practicing medicine, he would be negligent and he would be prosecuted. Joining us to talk about the documentary is Martin Smith, an Emmy-winning correspondent for PBS's Frontline and producer of the documentary, The Virus, What Went Wrong? You can watch it now online. Hi, Martin. Thank you for making this important documentary, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rose, and it's good to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. Martin, you began reporting on the virus several months ago. You returned from the Middle East, where you were covering events in Iran and Iraq, and you decided to quarantine to ask some very important questions. What were you hoping to accomplish with this documentary?
Right. I was on an assignment, if you remember, at the beginning of the year, Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani of Iran, was killed by a U.S. drone strike. And there was a lot of unrest both in Iraq and Iran. And I was covering that. And then I was ordered to come back. I was asked to put together this film. And I wanted to know if we were prepared. What did things look like going forward? So we got in covering it early, and we're trying to figure out what the American response would be. And it was really on the airplane ride on the way home that I formulated the idea of just following the timeline from Wuhan, China, out across Asia into the Middle East and Europe and to America, and looking at preparedness.
Well, we've done so many shows about COVID, Martin, and I learned a lot of new information in your documentary. So let's talk about some of those pieces of information. You report that on New Year's Eve, the CDC director, Dr. Robert Redfield, got a call from a CDC officer in China. He was on vacation at the time, Dr. Redfield. This was one of several calls that interrupted his vacation. What did New York Times reporter Michael Shear tell you about that conversation?
Well, that conversation, that first conversation on December 31st, was from the American CDC office in China. Our CDC, based in Atlanta, does have satellite offices around the world. So they simply informed him. But it was a couple of days later when Dr. Redfield called his counterpart in China, at the China CDC. And that call, according to Michael Shear of the New York Times, and he had several sources on this, became a very emotional call in which George Gao reportedly broke down in tears out of fear for what he was reporting to Dr. Redfield. So that was an early alarm that would certainly get anybody's attention that there was concern. And the reason that Michael Shear of the New York Times says that he believes that it was the fact that in China they had suffered in 2003 from SARS, and had really hit them hard. And there was a fear now that that experience was going to be repeated and perhaps could be worse.
So his counterpart in China breaks down crying, according to New York Times reporter Michael Shear. He really wanted to let Dr. Redfield know how serious this was. Dr. Redfield then called Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and then told the National Security Council at the White House. Now, you also report that Michael Shear, the reporter at the New York Times, said the virus began to pop up in Donald Trump's daily briefings, but still no one knows if he ever read those warnings.
Yeah, we know from the past that there's a lot of questions around whether or not the president ever reads his the PDB the presidential daily brief. And this is an amalgam of intelligence reports from across the intelligence community, the CIA and the DIA and other agencies of the government. But we don't know if he read those. But those early reports began to say, hey, this is something that could be serious and we should pay attention. Now, there's debate about what those early warnings look like. I have not firsthand seen what's inside the presidential daily brief. So we have to surmise a little bit, but there are reports that have leaked out that there were warnings that this could become a serious pandemic. But whether the president knew that or heard that, we don't know. Azar, on the other hand, when he gets the call from Redfield, does decide to try to get a meeting with the president. And, you know, this is early in January, and it's not for some time that he's able to do that.
Yeah, this was incredible. You report that Azar was trying to talk to Trump, but he didn't get a call back from Mar-a-Lago until 2 weeks later on January 18th. So here you have the director of Health and Human Services trying to get a meeting with Trump, but he didn't even get a call back until 2 weeks later.
Yeah, he wanted a meeting and he got a call, but he got a call on a weekend while from Mar-a-Lago. The content of that call has been reported. The fact of the delay was new to me as to how long he had been trying. But anyway, in the content of the call was that the president wanted to talk about e-cigarettes. There was pending legislation that would limit the sale of vaping devices, and the president wanted to talk about those regulations. So it was only at the end of the call that Azar was able to bring up the issue of this mysterious SARS-like virus that was killing people in China. So again, it's not at all clear that the president it seems clear that the president was not very alarmed at this point by any means.
Now, you wanted to talk to Azar about this, but he declined to be interviewed?
He did. He did. He declined to be interviewed, as many people in the administration declined to be interviewed. Redfield spoke to us with the approval of the White House, but others in the COVID-19 task force declined, including Azar.
And we'll talk about your conversations with Dr. Redfield in just a couple of minutes. So you report that on January 29th, White House economic advisor Peter Navarro sent Trump a memo that there was a risk of a massive loss of life. He said that flights should be halted. The next day, Azar told Trump that this might become a serious pandemic.
Yeah, it seems to be ramping up. If you get to the end of January, keep in mind that there were no deaths in the U.S. at that point, but we knew that there were a large number of deaths in China. Wuhan, where it originated, had been put on a lockdown. And I think a lot of people can remember the Caterpillar tractors swarming a sort of a hilltop and building a hospital in 10 days. And if nothing else, that got a lot of people's attention, because if the Chinese were going to expend that kind of energy and resource to building a hospital in under 10 days, something was really up. And so, you know, even though there were no deaths yet in the U.S., this was spreading in China, or killing a lot of people in Wuhan for sure. And, you know, there was all sorts of reason to be alarmed.
We're going to do, you know, entire shows about what happened in China, South Korea, Vietnam. And I just wonder, you spoke with Amy Chen, a reporter on China with the New York Times. You spoke with a number of people about what happened in Wuhan and in China. You talked about, Dr. Zhou Nongshang, a top advisor to the Chinese government who defied the party by speaking out. You have a segment about Dr. Li Wenglong, the doctor who tragically died on February 7th. He was telling people that he was worried on December 30th. What really struck you about what you learned about what happened in China? I mean, it's a big question, but is there one piece of information that hasn't gotten much attention yet?
Well, I think what happened in China is that their compulsion to control free speech, and all sorts of information did not serve them well, to say the least. So when Dr. Li Wenliang, who is an ophthalmologist in Wuhan, goes on to a chat room with some fellow medical school classmates and says, you know, there's this virus and we have to be concerned about this. He gets a visit from the police. The police come in and make and arrest him, bring him down to the station and make him sign a document that says he won't talk about this anymore. And the message then went out to all the media to say that anybody that's spreading any kind of rumors about this mysterious virus should be silent. And so this was exactly what you don't want. And when, as you mentioned, Li Wenliang contracts the virus and he struggles and then he dies by February 7th, at that point, the Chinese citizenry was outraged. They were outraged about the lack of free speech. They were outraged that this young man who had done the right thing, in their view, had died from the virus. And, you know, there was a spontaneous outpouring of people going to their windows with their cell phones, people blowing whistles to represent the actions of Dr. Li, the whistleblower. It was a very moving moment in the film. And then Dr. Zhang Nanchan, an 83-year-old pulmonologist, who's really pretty much a party advisor, a Communist Party advisor, really broke ranks with the party, came out, and in tears, you'll see it in the film, says this guy was a hero. And of course, the government was making a quick turnabout. And so by the time that Dr. Zhang Nanchan is saying this, it's sanctioned by the government because the government realizes that they're losing their people if they don't recognize that Dr. Li as a hero, because by that time they had identified it as a highly contagious disease spreading from human to human. Mm-hmm. But it's a tragic story. And I think what's important about it is that that kind of denial of science, that kind of denial of free speech is something we see subsequently throughout the film, including in the United States.
Exactly. Today we are speaking about a new Frontline documentary that you can watch right now. It's called The Virus, What Went Wrong? And we're speaking with Martin Smith, an Emmy-winning correspondent for PBS's Frontline. He is producer of this documentary. Martin will be with us until 35 after. So if you have any questions for Martin, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We talked a bit about Trump's daily briefing, about Dr. Redfield getting a call from a CDC counterpart in China. What else can you tell us just about how the information flowed from China to United States officials?
Well, you know, there are a number of ways. I mean, the CDC has an office in China, although under the Trump administration, it was shrunk significantly. People were taken out. There was also the Chinese CDC, and we know, as we've just talked about, the call from Dr. Gao, the head of the CDC in China, to Dr. Redfield. But, you know, the information, there were a lot of things distracting the president at the time. I mean, he was facing impeachment. He was trying to sign a trade deal with China. I mean, he successfully did sign a trade deal there in mid-January. So there are a lot of distractions. And in the fog of all of this, I think that information flow was compromised. I mean, you mentioned Dr. Navarro, who writes a lengthy memo at the end of the month. I mean, he's an economist. He's not an epidemiologist. He's not a statistician of, you know, he's not a biostatistician. But he recognized that given the possibility of human-to-human transmission and exponential growth, that is that things double every so many days, you quickly get to a very huge number. He was worried about social and economic consequences, as now we have seen that, you know, that has been the consequence of this COVID-19 ravaging the world.
I also want to ask you about the test. We've done several shows about this, but I'm still trying to figure out what happened. By January 28th, Alex Azar announced that a test was ready to go, but it was faulty, and that set testing back a month. And so many people in your documentary say that that was just really horrific. It really hurt so many efforts. What happened with that test? Whose mistake was that?
You know, and there's been a lot of obfuscation around this test, and I've heard Redfield on other interviews, and what he will often say is, look, the test was perfect. The test worked. What gets downplayed is the fact that when they tried to roll this out and manufacture enough tests to distribute to public health labs around the country, there was a flaw in one of the reagents. The reagent is a chemical that is going to then react with the sample that's swabbed from somebody suspected of having COVID-19, that reagent was not working properly. And it's believed by the CDC's investigators that that was because there was a contaminant in the process. So at that point, they have a faulty test. It can't be relied upon. So we have no visibility. Or reliable visibility on what's going on. It was very complicated because some of the tests worked, not all of them. Interestingly, the ones that were manufactured and sent out to New York City were among those that were most flawed. So we didn't have this tool. And then the CDC, facing sort of an emergency situation, decides to redo the manufacturing of the test and spends weeks doing that. And we lose more time. And there was an option to go to a German-developed test that the WHO was distributing, and they decided not to do that. And they didn't decide to even enlist the private labs around the country to develop their own tests until several weeks later. So nothing is more important than knowing where you need to do your contact tracing, where you need to apply your resources, where you need to send your equipment, then knowing where the outbreak is. Otherwise, you're just blind, and we're a big country. So that was botched, and I think of all things, the failure to test properly, expeditiously, given the growth of this, exponential growth, that's the biggest mistake.
It's incredible to compare what happened in the United States to South Korea, because in your documentary, we learn that on January 19th, South Korea had just 4 cases, and healthcare officials there summoned 20 companies to get together. This was carried out by the Korean CDC. 4 companies developed a test. A week later, 1 was approved. This is a process that usually takes a year, but it was completed in just a week. And they were testing 10,000 people a day. They actually acted before they needed to act.
And that 10,000 a day is mind-blowing. I mean, it's mind-blowing that they responded as quickly as they did, and I'll talk about why that was. But 10,000 people a day are being tested. In the United States, you get into somewhere in March, and we've only tested in total 4,000 people. Mm. So, you know, we are way behind and way, you know, totally flat-footed. Now, the reason that they were so successful has a lot to do with the fact that in 2015, they had an outbreak of the Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS, and that got them, that got their attention. They organized their healthcare system to respond to this kind of respiratory outbreak. And so they had this experience, and that made them ready. And they were willing to work with the private sector and coordinate in a way that the U.S. healthcare system, which is very bifurcated and divided against itself, just wasn't prepared to do. Finally, famously, Dr. Fauci goes before Congress and admits it was a failure. And he says, it's a failure. Let's admit it.
I was wondering, Martin, just watching the documentary, okay, the United States turned down the German test. Why didn't they work with the South Koreans, given that they had these incredible tests?
Because of hubris, I guess. I mean, the CDC has had a very good record. The CDC is very respected around the world. Its standards are high, or have been, and never before has anyone seen a test fail like this. So, you know, the past experience had taught the Americans that they knew what they were doing and that they would turn this around and fix the problem. Unfortunately, they couldn't do it quickly. And so we lost valuable time during which the COVID-19 was spreading in communities unknown to us.
In addition to losing valuable time, a lot of people who needed a test couldn't get one. We meet Dr. Daniel Griffin. He's a doctor at the New York Presbyterian Hospital in your documentary. He said that he was very concerned that the United States wasn't prepared. This was in February. He was pressing for more tests for weeks. He said the CDC said, unless someone is severely ill, they need to have a direct contact or a travel history, then they cannot get tested. Even if you want to do widespread testing, because let's say you think that there's a cluster, you can't do it.
You know, and it's doubly absurd because as we now know, this has been a disease that has attacked the poor communities at rates significantly greater than the wealthier among us. And to ask somebody in the documentary, there's a mother whose daughter is running a fever of 105 and wants to get her tested and can't do it because she's asked, has she been to China? I mean, the absurdity of having that being one of the boxes that needs to get checked before you can have a test is disturbing. I mean, she wasn't at that point coughing and having trouble breathing. But she had 105 fever. And of course, as you see in the documentary, it becomes quite a family tragedy for Jessica and ultimately her mother and aunt.
This was so hard to watch, Martin, because you got up close video of Jessica talking to her mom. Of course, from a distance, they were on FaceTime. And it's just heart-wrenching that so many families are talking to their loved ones from a distance, and the nurse and the hospital staff are the ones that have to kind of facilitate this.
You know, there's a lot of people that have sort of posited the idea, look, a lot of these people are elderly, some have, they're in bad shape anyway, they weren't going to maybe live that long. But the idea that we take these people and have them die alone without holding the hand of their loved ones is just it's a horror. And we've seen it around the world now because these the hospitals can't allow family members into the wards to be next to their loved ones. And so it's a heart-wrenching tragedy. When I first saw the pictures of Jessica's mother intubated on a ventilator, it was just it still gets to me.
Today we're speaking with Martin Smith, an Emmy-winning correspondent for PBS's Frontline and producer of the must-see documentary The Virus: What Went Wrong. You can watch it now online. Find a link at yourcallradio.org. Let's take a few callers and questions. Let's go to Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay, great. Thank you. The documentary was spectacular and all was so dramatically presented when it's Frontline. It's really superb. I have a big question, though. Why is it really the reason we weren't prepared is we weren't prepared? We didn't have the team that Obama had pulled together in 14, and very little time was spent on that, I think, in the documentary. That's why we weren't prepared. Nobody was doing anything.
Well, it's true. We weren't responding. That team wasn't entirely disbanded. It was reorganized, as we pointed out in the documentary. John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, says that he doesn't think it affected their ability to respond. But a number of other people we spoke to say it did. And so, you know, that is one factor. The bigger factor is simply that we were flat-footed and didn't call for social distancing measures soon enough. And it would have been easy, even without the pandemic response team in the White House, to see what was happening in China, in Iran, in Italy, in Spain. And, you know, this was coming, and we simply stayed on the beach while the storm rolled in. There's a study done at Columbia University that calculated that had the American government called for social distancing 3 weeks sooner, 83% of all lives lost in the U.S. could have been saved.
Yeah, that's an incredible study. We should also say, Martin, that people were trying to sound the alarm bells. Dr. Nancy Messonnier with the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Disease at CDC in February, when Trump was in India, said we will see community spread in the United States. And as she was giving this briefing, Trump was flying home from India. New York Times reporter Michael Shear said Trump hadn't been briefed about any of this. It made major news. It affected stocks. He was fuming and he was angry. You know, instead of trying to learn more about what Dr. Messonnier was saying, he picked up the phone and yelled at Azar.
The president is running for re-election. He is today. He was then. He evaluates his moves based on what he thinks. At least it's apparent to me as a reporter that he's basing his moves very much on how it will affect his electability, his re-electability. So scientists like Nancy Messonnier don't get listened to. They spend a press conference walking back what she had said. And the president wants to give a positive message. Azar is removed from the task force at that time, and Vice President Pence is put in charge with no clear credentials to lead a response to a pandemic. So it was very disturbing to see how the government responded at that point in time. And that was during that time whereby if we had called for social distancing, for staying, you know, calling people to shelter in place, we could have saved tens of thousands of lives, but we didn't.
Dr. Messonnier was also sidelined. So according to so many studies, as you said, the Columbia study, lives could have been saved. And in our final moments, Martin, what did you hear from people about accountability? Dr. David Ho had a damning statement. He's director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center at Columbia. He said if Trump were practicing medicine, he would be negligent and he would be prosecuted.
Well, I doubt that he will be. But, you know, Dr. Ho has all sorts of credibility here. Dr. Ho worked to stem the spread of SARS in 2003. He's still a prominent researcher on AIDS. So, you know, that's his take on it, that the president, in essence, was practicing medicine. I mean, we've seen the hydrochloroquine and I always mispronounce it, excuse me, but the advice that he's given around Clorox and other things, it is, in a sense, practicing medicine. People do listen to this.
I also want to mention, because this is Juneteenth, Martin, and so many people are celebrating, so many people are protesting. The Black Lives Matter movement has exploded. And in your documentary, so many studies have shown that COVID-19 has been twice as deadly for Blacks and Latinos as it has for whites.
That's right.
And I also want to put Indigenous people in there because the Navajo Nation just went on lockdown again.
Yes. I mean, I'm glad you're raising this again, as I raised it at the beginning of our conversation. But it is the case that so many people of color, minorities, the poor, have suffered at a rate much greater than whites. And this pandemic has exposed the inequities that exist in our society. In a way that I hope it gives people reason to pay closer attention to how we've constructed our healthcare system, and about how we deal with the disparities, the inequities that plague our society.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for your work on this documentary, you and your team, and thank you for joining us.
Rose, thank you very much for having me.
Martin Smith is an Emmy-winning correspondent for PBS's Frontline and producer of the documentary, The Virus, What Went Wrong. You can watch it now online. There's a lot of new information in there. I hope you can watch it and share it widely. We will continue to do shows about who will be held accountable, who will be investigated for not taking measures on COVID-19. Coming up after a break, we will talk about today's Juneteenth actions across the country, including the major ILWU West Coast dock worker strike. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about today's Juneteenth actions, including the ILWU West Coast dock worker strike. According to Vice, 38,000 union dockyard workers are shutting down all 29 of the Pacific Coast ports to protest the killing of George Floyd. McDonald's workers in Chicago are on strike today, demanding McDonald's stop putting Black employees' lives at risk from COVID-19. Today's guest, Mike Elk, reports that the strikes come as workers have walked off the job at over 500 employers in the last 3 weeks alone. If the size of these strikes last week is any indication, today, Juneteenth, will be the largest day of strikes in more than a generation. Mike Elk is a labor reporter and founder of Payday Report, a grassroots news organization covering labor issues. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show. We are also joined by writer Matthew Cunningham Cook. In one of his latest pieces for The Intercept, he writes about the AFL-CIO's police union problem. He writes that police have a small but politically and ideologically influential presence in some of the country's largest and most progressive unions, like the United Food and Commercial Workers, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and the American Federation of Government Employees. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great to have you, Matthew. I just want to ask you, since you wrote a piece, How to Mark Juneteenth in the Year 2020, you write that some of the discourse surrounding Juneteenth is palatable to corporate America because it can reinforce some of the comforting ideas about the Civil War that Abraham Lincoln and the generals of the Union Army in their benevolence freed the slaves. The reality, you write, argued W.E.B. Du Bois in a series of landmark works, is that 500,000 Black Americans freed themselves from slavery by walking off their plantation. Since so many people are talking about Juneteenth today, tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, so the context for all of this is starting about 40 years before Du Bois wrote this book, Black Reconstruction. Some historians at Columbia University, known as the Dunning School, began to advance a really pernicious set of ideas that basically said Reconstruction was not the explosion of democracy that it actually was. Instead, it was a cesspool of corruption. Black America, the war was not actually about slavery at all. It was about Northern aggression and states' rights. There were the rehabilitation of Confederate generals like Robert E. Lee. You see this to this day. You will see, you know, high school students saying, you know, Robert E. Lee, you know, I was thought he was a decent guy. And that really comes out of the Dunning School. And I really think the foundation of the arguments they were making was a denial of Black agency, a denial of the critical role played by Black workers in both kind of sparking the Civil War and in its resolution. And basically what Du Bois found in his study of the Civil War in particular was that the Union Army could not have won the war without emancipation. The Emancipation Proclamation was not a moral move by Lincoln so much as it was a critical tactical decision that Lincoln made under pressure from his radical Republican generals to issue the proclamation, because only if the South's logistics system broke down would the Union Army be able to win the war? And basically what he found is half a million black folks deserted their plantations, formed huge massive refugee camps that at the beginning had really atrocious conditions, but then some of the radical Republican officers in the Union Army aligned with some of the black folks who had military training, formed an officer corps, organized the freed people, and began Reconstruction. And that's really what the article is about. And I really think that's what Juneteenth is about. You know, you see these CEOs kind of tweeting this this kind of PR for Juneteenth, and really, you know, if you make your living as the CEO of Target does, exploiting black and brown workers, making 767 times the average Target worker does in a year, you know, that really means that you're not actually honoring the true legacy of Juneteenth. If you were serious about honoring the legacy of Juneteenth, you would allow your workers to organize free of management interference. But unfortunately, there's no company in America today that doesn't actively work to obstruct their workers' right to join a union.
Well, it's such an important piece. And as we talk about the history, it's important to get the history right and to make the connections as you do. And I hope you can read Matthew's piece. It's at yourcallradio.org. Connected to what Matthew says about Target CEO making 767 times the average worker, Mike, McDonald's workers are on strike today in Chicago. That the ILWU is shutting down 29 of the Pacific ports to protest the killing of George Floyd. It'll be the largest work stoppage that one of the country's most powerful unions has undertaken in more than a decade. Can you talk about the significance of these labor strikes and actions on Juneteenth, Mike?
Well, we're seeing a massive surge in strikes happening right now. You know, I run Payday Report. You know, we're a crowdfunded site, and we've been using crowdsourcing to track strikes. Between March 1st and May 31st, we identified at least 260 strikes over a three-month period, which is pretty high, but certainly not regular. I've never quite seen anything like that, but it's not exactly unprecedented, you know, that's happened. But what we saw in the last 3 weeks is over 500 strikes as the Black Lives Matter movement protests start, you know, they've led to a huge surge in strikes. And I think it's important to bring up why. During this, you know, pandemic, African-American workers are, you know, a disproportionate amount of frontline industry workers. Not only are they a disproportionate amount of frontline industry workers, but black workers are likely to be, they're likely to be retaliated against at twice the rate of white workers. Black workers are much more likely to not be able to take time off from work than white workers. And what we're seeing is a combination of these things coming together and really fueling right now a massive strike movement. And in my analysis, it's only going to get bigger because next month, the pandemic unemployment assistance benefits, those are benefits that give people an extra $600 a week, are set to expire. So we're seeing a huge, huge strike wave occurring. And I don't think we've seen a strike wave this big since the closing days of World War II, when people struck over wages being frozen. So this is really uncharted territory in the modern era.
What would you add, Matthew? It's looking at the McDonald's workers, very low-paid workers, saying, stop exploiting black people. We still don't have enough PPE.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's always, I mean, one of the connections between McDonald's today and Juneteenth is the sugar industry, you know, which during slavery, black folks were ruthlessly exploited to create the modern sugar trade. And then today, the high amounts of sugar and corn syrup in McDonald's food kind of leads itself to the Black community kind of being disproportionately affected by COVID-19, disproportionately affected by a host of major public health issues. And it's not just Black folks, but all working class people are kind of affected by this deliberate decision by companies like McDonald's to poison their own customers. So I think you really, with this strike, you see Black folks not only kind of interrupting this whole massive profit machine that is McDonald's, but also interrupting what frankly is a public health disaster, as really evidenced by COVID-19. You know, the point I'd also like to make about the dock workers, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know it and you know it, but, you know, this is a union that was forged in the 1934 general strike. And that general strike was when Du Bois came up with his theory of the general strike that ended the Civil War. So it was really the actions of folks like Harry Bridges and the ILWU that led Du Bois to craft this incredibly novel theoretical formulation, which was the mass general strike that ended the war. So that, I think, is another really interesting historical connection here, is the ILWU really created the conditions for this new type of historical analysis, and then today it's carrying it forward. Really, I think if we see Juneteenth become a national holiday, I think we can really credit the actions of the 40,000 dock workers today to that, in the same way that they often took Martin Luther King Day off in the 70s and early 80s, and that created the conditions for a national MLK Day holiday.
Right. And also, they refused to process cargo from apartheid South Africa throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yes.
They led the anti-war protests at the Port of Oakland in 2003, shut down ports in protest of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the assault on Gaza. So they're very active. And we're going to do a show about dock workers again in the coming weeks. I just want to ask both of you, and I want to make sure we leave time to talk about the unions and the police unions, Matthew. I just want to ask both of you where we are right now in terms of labor activism, looking at the history of the dock workers. And then, Mike, the New Yorker reported in February that according to a Gallup poll last summer, 64% of Americans approve unions. It's one of the highest ratings recorded in the past 50 years. The highest rate of approval came from young people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. And some of them have to do with class issues, which is that people saw a recession come by and they didn't earn money. But we know that people don't organize solely around class issues. Actually, we know that the number one indicator of whether or not someone wants to join a union is their race. Studies show that African Americans are twice as likely to support unions as white Americans. And why is that? You know, a lot of experts, and we came out with a story this morning at my site, paydayreport.com, a lot of experts say that the reason for that is that, you know, a lot of white Americans, you know, they think, oh, yeah, you know, someday I'm going to be the boss. They look like the boss. They feel like, oh, yeah, maybe I could fit in.
Yes.
Black Americans don't live under that illusion. They know they're not the boss. And they know they're very rarely the boss. And what winds up happening is studies show that African Americans, women, minorities, the disabled, wind up supporting unions a lot more for these reasons. So a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, if we just organize around class, all these messy race issues will go away. I would say that's a terribly racist theory, one, and a terribly bad form of journalism, two. So often, issues of race are what drive union drives. Union drives are driven by a sense often of respect, of the need to get respect. And, you know, I think Robert Greene, the historian, is in my story, is talking about how when we talk about the labor movement, when we talk about huge gains of the labor movement, we always erase that black workers were often at the front of these movements, and that black workers so often inspire white workers to be bold. It's not that black workers add to the equation. It's that black workers are typically the ones in a lot of workplaces driving the conversation. And we miss that. And I think a big part of the reason that we miss that is that the press is so white. You know, studies show that 83% of newsrooms are white in a country that only 60% of people are white. You know, I was trying to think, you know, outside of Matt, you know, who's black, that I can only think of three or four other labor reporters off the top of my head that are black. And, you know, I've been in this business a long time, and I know most folks. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly there's some folks that cover labor part-time, but on a full-time basis, there's about four labor reporters I can think of off the top of my head that are black. And this is a huge reason. We get these very white-driven narratives that, you know, workers organize around income. Yeah, that's one part of the equation. But workers organize around a sense of empowerment and a sense of a desire for respect. And the workers often driving that are women, are people of color, are the disabled, are immigrants, are people that know the boss isn't on their side and that they need to take collective action to fight back. And what we've seen, these strikes prove, is that we had 260 strikes over the first 3 months of the pandemic, which is not seen in decades. When we saw these strikes become about so much more than just COVID, when they became about the George Floyd murder, when they became about other issues, we all of a sudden saw a massive strike wave of over 500 strikes in 3 weeks. So that tells you something. The forces that drive people to strike are intersectional, and to just boil it down to class, or what some people call class reductionism, is a terrible way of doing journalism, not to mention a very racist way of doing journalism.
Matthew, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of, you know, switch gears slightly to cover the police union issue, I think that, you know, one of the kind of questions that the labor is really grappling with is who we are as a movement, and whether or not there's a role for police unions in that movement, and how do we confront the power of the police without confronting the police unions. And I think that's a question that we really have to draw out in a systematic way. I think what this, you know, if as Mike points out, the big spark for this new movement is police murder, then what does it say that a lot of the largest international unions, for example, like AFSCME or UFCW, have large police presence as in their union? I don't think there's any easy answers here, but I definitely think it's really critically important that we begin to have these conversations in a systematic way and really tie it in with kind of deeper questions about why we haven't been able to organize Walmart, about why we haven't been able to organize Amazon, about why we haven't been able to organize Target, or really any major retail industry. And I think these are kind of really difficult questions for us to answer, but we certainly need to start having a conversation right now because, you know, as Mike points out, workers are on the march, but capital is also on the march. I mean, Jeff Bezos is more powerful than any industrialist since John D. Rockefeller at this point. And the level of control that he has over our democracy is really dangerous. And it seems to be growing only by the day. And it seems absolutely imperative for us to come up with a way to organize Amazon and Whole Foods and end the closed shop and the open shop at the Washington Post. But we don't have a clear sense of direction for that going forward.
Matthew, we only have about a minute left, but I just want to ask you about some news that came out yesterday. I'm reading from the AP. The largest labor group in the Seattle area has expelled the city's police union, saying the guild representing officers failed to address racism within its ranks. The vote Wednesday night by the King County Labor Council to exclude the Seattle Police Officers Guild comes weeks after the protests. It's also significant as the Labor Council is politically influential. What are your thoughts on that, just briefly?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is obviously an incredibly important step forward. And this is not a really left-wing labor council, actually. You know, in 2019, they actually didn't even endorse Shama Sawant for re-election. Many individual members of that labor council did, but the only socialist on the Seattle City Council, due to kind of the influence of conservative sections among the building trades and the police union, for that matter. I think it's an important step forward. That said, you know, I really don't think that we can elide kind of these more deeper questions and looking at kind of the state of labor in a more systematic way. The fact is that private union density in the private sector is lower than any time in the last over 100 years. It's the lowest since any time prior to World War I. And that presents a really serious, and the remaining pockets in the private sector are all in highly regulated industries, like telecom, or healthcare. We're presented with, some really deep and fundamental questions of who we are, and, we really need to, address that going forward.
Matthew Cunningham Cook writes for a number of publications, including The Intercept and The Nation, and you can find his pieces, The AFL-CIO's Police Union Problem is Bigger Than You Think, and How to Mark Juneteenth in the Year 2020 at yourcallradio.org. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Mike Elk is a labor reporter and founder of Payday Report, a grassroots news organization covering labor issues. You can also find Mike's reporting at yourcallradio.org. Thank you again for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for always having great discussions about the movement, Rose. You do a great job.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.